I didn't know it was going to be so hard to find somebody to introduce me. My name is Jerry. I'm an alcoholic. Either that or I have varicose nose. I don't know which, you know. So. Last week when I started talking, I said we're going to start talking about the steps in order, but I start off a little bit differently than most people do. I start off at -1, and then I work up to 0 before I get to 1. And the reason I do that is because really that's the way we come into the program. We don't come in, ready to admit we're powerless over alcohol most of the time. We don't get to that decision sometimes. Or maybe when we get here, you know, my sponsor told me one time he had never had a slip. And I slipped and slid around this program for a couple of years. And he said, the only difference between you and me, Jerry, is that I had all my slips before I came in. Okay? He had reached his bottom. He had admitted that he was powerless. Hopeless is the word I used last week. And as I mentioned, I didn't invent that word. It's in the big book. It's in a doctor's opinion if you look it up. And we started talking about some of the reasons why this disease, and it really is a disease, and when Dr. Silkworth came up with that theory, it was just a theory at that time. And some of the things that they've discovered about this disease, excuse me, I still slip into slur once in a while, okay, that they discovered about this disease that is very consistent. You want me to eat the mic? How's that? Better? Okay. Where was I? Okay. Anyway, you know, they say there's three things that happen when you become alcoholic, and the first is your memory goes, right? And then, I can't remember the other two. But anyway. But, you know, what I was talking about was THIQ and how that forms on a brain. It's a brand new chemical, and in alcoholics, process alcohol completely differently than the average person. And I've had people tell me, was there any kind of test? You know, well, yeah, they can cut open their brain and see the, you know. And I'm pretty convinced I'm an alcoholic. Can you imagine how embarrassed I'd be at my autopsy if they cut open my brain and don't find any THIQ on there? And, well, he went to all those AA meetings all the time for anything. But what we're talking about is, you know, that kind of knowledge, you know, that's, pay attention. But that kind of knowledge, that's experiential. That's not experiential knowledge. That's head knowledge. The way most of us learn about powerlessness and about the disease of alcoholism is experientially. And that's what I'm going to talk about today, is getting through step 0 to step 1. Okay, step -1 is denial, and we talked a little bit about that. A lot of us learn about what we've experienced after we get into AA. And we experience powerlessness in varying degrees. And I like to kind of, there's one characteristic that I see in people that just have a real hard time with this program, and that trait is willfulness. You know, thanks for the information, but I think I'm still going to do it this way. And last week I used the example of the guy, you know, probably me, you know, out there drowning, you know, and a boat comes along and they throw me a life raft. And I say, well, wait a minute, I haven't tried the backstroke yet. Let me try that, you know, for a little while first. And that's kind of the way I approached, you know, AA. You know, they were giving me good information, but I still wasn't quite done doing it my way. And basically, I wasn't ready to admit that I was powerless. I was not at step 1 when I got into AA. I was at step -1, and it took me for a while to get to step 0, as you'll see, and then finally to get to step 1. I hope that you don't have to go through it, and there's some descriptions of different ways that people can get to step 1 at the end of the first chapter of the 12 and 12, and we'll talk about that. I also mentioned that I believe that the major reason people don't get this program or that they relapse, and this is just a personal opinion, okay, it has nothing to do with the big book, but I've seen it myself, I've seen it in other people, is they cannot accept entirely what step 1 means with all its implications, you know, and they can't understand what that really means. And I used the word hopeless quite a bit last week when describing this. When I look back on it, long before I knew I was an alcoholic, and I was an alcoholic long before I knew I was an alcoholic. You know, everybody else knew I was an alcoholic. I didn't know I was an alcoholic. But long before then, I always treated alcohol differently. You ever notice that? And when you look back in your history and say, gee, yeah, no, I never sat down and drank a 6-pack of Coca-Cola in one sitting and then hide the can so nobody knew how much, you know. Nobody does that, you know, with Coca-Cola. I don't understand why. You know, first of all, they don't drink a 6-pack of Coke in one sitting, and secondly, they don't bother hiding the cans. You know, who cares, you know? But for some reason, you know, that was kind of the way my drinking progressed over a period of time. Another thing it tells me that I always treated alcohol differently. When I was in my early 20s, I was still deciding what I was going to be when I grew up. In fact, I'm still deciding what I'm going to be when I grow up. I joined the Peace Corps and I went to South America. And I lived in this little village on the border of Bolivia and Brazil. And I lived the way those people lived. They didn't have electricity, they didn't have running water. And I lived in a dirt hut, thatched roof. And I ate what they ate, and I drank what they drank. Okay? Now, in Bolivia, what happens is everything in that little village, there were no roads, so everything was flown in. And beer was very expensive. It was like the equivalent of a dollar a bottle. And they only gave me $75 to live on a month. You know, it doesn't take a mathematical genius to figure out it's hard to be an alcoholic, you know, a practicing alcoholic, when beer is a dollar a bottle and you're going to get $75 a month. But see, these Bolivians had a solution to that problem. They made their own, okay? And they made a couple different things. One was called trago. And what trago was, they kind of crunched up sugar cane and let the juice flow out, and then they'd let it sit. And I mean, that stuff, they sold it in cans that looked like gasoline cans. You could probably run an engine with it, you know? And it was supposed to make you go blind, sterile, or all the above, you know? And I don't think it had that effect. I mean, I've had five kids, so then. I think it did burn some hair off my head, though. Just hope the glare isn't bothering anybody out there. But it made you crazy in the head. It made you crazy in the head. Made you sick in the head. Made me sick in the head. The other stuff was even worse, and it was cheaper. That was good, though. Yeah. It was worse. That was bad. But it was cheaper. That was good. And it was called chicha. And the way they made chicha is the Indians would chew up, you know, fruit and vegetables, and they'd spit it into a vat and let the enzymes from the saliva ferment that in a big hurry. Okay? And the best chicha was supposed to be made by young virgins. Whoa. Okay? And I think I got some that was made by, you know, 98-year-old, you know, whatever. Anyway, whereas trago made me sick in the head, chicha made me sick all over. Okay? I mean, my breath would speak Spanish both ends, you know, for 3 days after I couldn't get more than 10 feet from a latrine. I'd get Montezuma's Revenge so bad, and then when I got there, I didn't know where to bend over or sit down, and then it didn't make any difference anyway. So, I mean, it was just terrible. But you know what? I look back on it, and for 2 years that I was in that village, I drank that stuff over and over and over again, okay? Because it was available, because it was cheap. And you know, I don't do that with anything else in my life. I hate sauerkraut. Sauerkraut gives me a sour stomach, you know, and it gets caught up here, you know, kind of brings back some memories. But anyway, sauerkraut just has bad effect on me. I will not go into a restaurant and order sauerkraut. But if sauerkraut juice was the only thing that they made alcohol out of, I'd have probably gone in and ordered sauerkraut juice over and over and over again. I always treated alcohol differently. That should have been a clue. Another clue was that I had a high tolerance early on. I mentioned my sister dated this guy that was 24 years old, and he wanted to take little brother out, me, right, and take him out drinking so he can get the scoop on, you know, what is Alice really like in a guy, you know, so he takes me out drinking, and guess who drove whom home? You know, little 16-year-old brother, 17-year-old brother drove the 24-year-old mature man home. And he said to my sister, your brother can't really put it, I mean, drank the guy under the table. Well, instead of telling me that that was a symptom of a disease, what it told me at that age was, Jerry, you finally found something you can do well. You know? All right? You can really hold your booze, you know? I mean, this is something to be proud of when you're 16, 17 years old. You can drink somebody else under the table. So there was a lot of symptoms there. Along with the progression of the disease, there's a progression of denial. Okay? And I don't know anybody else's story, so I can't tell that, so I'm going to have to relate that to kind of some of the things that happened to me. Most of the time, when things began to happen, remember I tell you, you begin to have little experiences that aren't good. One of my first one was knocking out my best friend's teeth when I was drinking. And that kind of hurts your, you know, you worry about it. God, what are you going to think of me? And so forth and so on. And then you start building these little excuses around it that sound, you know, perfectly logical. They did to me, right? Well, I drank on an empty stomach, and that's why I blacked out. Or that's why I got sick. I had ice cream instead of it. I heard that if you drank cream, that you wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't get as drunk as quickly. And I try to do that, and you still get drunk and sick. You just, you know, it's cottage cheese instead of, but anyway. But those little things are embarrassing, but you can kind of build this little fence around it, you know, little tapes like the old bands the police used to put around places where I was. And And it would kind of, you know, it was a little barrier, and it was penetrable, but it was so logical sounding that people didn't really bother too much to penetrate it. Oh yeah, you know, he just had too much to drink one time. But then as time goes on, it begins to get worse and worse and worse. More and more things happen. And I mentioned mowing down my neighbor's backyard, my neighbor's mailboxes. And then not having a sense of humor about that. I had to solve that problem. You begin to get other people's attention, okay? So we solved that problem by moving to a new neighborhood. You know, those neighbors don't have a sense of humor, we'll find some others. At first, the problems are at home, and your wife begins to mention it, or your husband, you know, whatever the case may be. You're Alan Monster, I mean, that's true. Thanks, I didn't mean that, okay? We joke around a lot. You know, Al-Anons can have a slip, and it's just a moment of compassion, but alcoholics have a slip, man, we go out and die, you know. Okay. Anyway, I love the Al-Anon program. It has really helped the family a whole lot. In fact, I only got into AA so my wife would get into Al-Anon and get better. But at first, it just kind of affects around the family, and that's fine because it's in the family. And I mentioned, you know, how normal kids kind of greet their parents when they come home, daddy, 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 grab his leg and hang, give me a horsepower, give me a hug. You know, in my family, when I got home, my kids would look at me and say, what's he like today? Okay? And I began to have, and the whole family can get like this. I mean, even the dog. I housebroke my first dog when I was drinking. You know what that's like? I would be the kind of drunk that would pass out on the couch and maybe sometimes urinate on the couch and the next day blame the dog for it. You know, come here, look what you did, you know. And dog, after a while, I'd say, come here. And he'd say, ooh, you know, you're crazy. You know. It's not mine. And then I'd get home and I'd call the dog and the dog would run away and hide, you know. And that's a thing. But anyway, since I've been sober, the wife went to Al-Anon, the kids went to Al-Teen, the dog went to Al-Dog, you know, whole family. But at first it gets, you know, it's in the family. And as long as it's in the family, I can kind of, you know, keep that barrier around there. And then it begins to get other people's attention, okay? Other people begin to notice. And at first it might be the people that you drink with. You know, he's a good guy, but maybe he just drinks a little bit differently than we do. I remember one night waking up, you ever do this? You ever sneak home, you know, and kind of tiptoe up? And I did this in North Carolina one time. We live in North Carolina, and it was in the summertime. And I snuck upstairs, you know, it was real quiet, and I laid on top of the sheets because I didn't want to wake it up, or her. I didn't want to wake my wife up, okay, at that time. And I didn't know it because I was in blackout, but I had somehow split my head and back, and I was bleeding, okay? Well, I slept that way all night. So the blood dried, see? And when I woke up in the morning, the sheets were kind of stuck to the back of my head. Okay. So I sat up in bed, and my wife felt these sheets being pulled off her, and she sees this ghostly specter rising. So she reaches over and turns on the light and pulls off the sheet, you know? And starts screaming. And I said, what are you screaming for? She says, you're bleeding. I said, well, why are you screaming? I'm the one who's bleeding, you know. She asked me what happened. I had absolutely no idea what happened. You know, it kind of struck me as unusual. But I went downstairs, look at the cars, blood on the back seat, on the back of the front seat, you know, no new dents. You know how you tell the new dents from the old ones? No rust in them, right? Okay. Yeah, that's some alcoholics in here. There's people shaking their head. Yeah, I know that. And pilots do flight checks, you know, around the plane. Alcoholics do alcoholic car checks. They look around for new dents and blood and hair, you know, and that type of thing. But anyway, I didn't know what happened. And all day long, I'm going around trying to figure out what happened. The car wasn't dented up. I thought maybe I got mugged. I had my money. All day long, it was driving me nuts. And then I went back to the lounge that I usually drank in, which was Corky's. And it's kind of a pool hall beer place combined. And they had the pool table set in a little pit. And when I walked in, Corky says, are you okay? I said, well, yeah. You know, my head's all bandaged. Oh, why do you ask? He said, man, we thought we were going to bleed to death last night. We were going to call the ambulance, and you wouldn't let us. And he told me what happened is I kept backing the bar stool up until the back two legs went down into the pit, and I just went back and hit the back of my head on a pool table and didn't know it, you know, and insisted I drive home. And how do we get around that, you know? I mean, that's kind of unusual. We made a joke about it. In fact, the next couple times I came back in, they had training wheels on a bar stool with one of these director chair type things in the back and Jerry's bar stool, you know, a seatbelt on it, that type of thing. And then as time goes on, we begin to get other people's attention. sometimes we get the police's attention. And unfortunately, they were not as tough on DUIs back then in North Carolina as they are on DUIs today. Now they're really tough on it. But then they, you know, you could kind of, you just had too much to drink, and give them a ride home and let them go. And I don't think they did me any favors by doing that. But that's what would happen on some occasions. And the last, you know what the last thing we begin to get people's attention is the job. It's the job. The last place that you, the place that you're going to cover up the most is the job, because that is the source. You know, as long as I got that, I can always get some money, and I'm always going to be able to pay the bills, and everything's going to be okay, and that's kind of who I am. Well, you know, my job, one of my first jobs when I got married, was I started off as a baby photographer. And the drunk baby photographer. I'm sorry, man, we can't seem to get this kid in focus, you know. And I wore puppets on both hands. I was the only person in the world that had athlete's finger. It was just terrible. It's distracting me. What would happen is I worked at that job for a lot of years. Now, it was grounds for immediate dismissal if you were drunk on the job as a baby photographer, for good reason. So I never got drunk on the job, but I was always go afterwards, and when other guys would eat their dinner, I would drink mine. And it would last for quite a while. But as time went on, I got promoted. And I got to be a large portrait studio company, and I began to travel and to deal with executives instead of with babies. And now they gave me an expensive account, and instead of it being grounds for dismissal for being drunk on a job, now drinking became part of the job. What an alcoholic dream, you know. Give them an expense account, you give them some credit cards, put them on a plane and send them off, right? And that's when my drinking really, really began to progress. Because when you're out of town, nobody knows, right? That's what you think? Nobody knows? Right? That's what you think. Okay. But they eventually begin to find out. And one of the first, it was not really one of the first. I used to think nobody knew how much I drank. You know, and people say, would you ever see Foster Brooks do his imitation of Wary Jepster? You know, that type of thing. So they had jokes about it, and I didn't know about it. Yeah. Jerry had a bad accident. You know, he dropped his drink in a driveway and got glass in his tongue when he went to clean it up. You know, that type of thing. But anyway, I had one occasion where I was supposed to, I had worked my way up, and I was traveling internationally, and I was supposed to fly to Japan to have this meeting with a Japanese firm. And we took off from Charlotte, and the plane landed in O'Hare, and I had a layover. And they did not serve drinks when a plane was on the ground. And I was very indignant about this, because I don't know how you all flew, but I always made sure I was at the airport plenty early, okay? And I would wait in a lounge until a plane was ready, and then I would get on the plane and I'd, you know, order some more. But anyway, I got very indignant about it, and I knew that plane was going to be sitting there for a while, and I knew there had to be a watering hole right at the end of the ramp. So I got off the plane, and I said, well, I'll just go to the ramp and, you know, find a bar at the end of the ramp and have a few drinks and then get back on a plane. Well, I got off the plane, got to the bar at the end of the ramp, and went into a blackout. Okay, the plane took off without me. At about 3 o'clock in the morning, the Japanese were calling my boss at home. Oh, mushy mushy, Jerry-san in Charlotte, you know. No, he's in Tokyo. Oh, Jerry-san no arrive. His luggage arrived, and his plane arrived, but he no arrived, you know. So what does my boss do? He calls my wife, all right? Hey, is Jerry at home? No, he's in Tokyo. And pretty soon, nobody knew where I was. Everybody's calling all over the place. In the meantime, my boss gets on a plane and flies to Japan to hold this meeting that I am missing. And I come out of a blackout at a hotel at O'Hare Airport, O'Hare Hilton, I think it's called. And I got a ticket to go to Tokyo in my hand. So I get on the next plane, fly to Tokyo. I think it's the same day. Okay. My boss flew home with me. A 19-hour plane ride. Okay, and we sat next to each other, and the whole time back he was talking to me about this friend of mine, ex-friend actually, his name was John, who had this drinking problem, and what a great job John was doing since he straightened up. And the whole time he was talking about John, I was drinking and agreeing with him, and said, that guy was really a mess, you're absolutely right, you know, I'm glad he got his life straightened around, if I ever get that bad. Anyway, and finally, as we started to pull into Charlotte, he recognized I wasn't getting the hint, and he says, Jerry, you can't do this. What is wrong with you? What, I mean, you can't just, take off and disappear for a couple of days and nobody knows where you are and you're supposed to be. What in the world is wrong with you? And I knew I was in trouble. And I knew I had to tell him what was wrong with me. So I told him what was wrong with me. I'm under so much pressure and I'm all away from home all the time and I never see my family and so many hours and everything except drinking. And so he says, okay, I'm going to try and help you out, Jerry. And what he did is he kept me off the road. In fact, he demoted me, didn't cut my pay, and gave the traveling part of my job to my assistant. You know what happens when an alcoholic gets demoted and treated so unfairly? You know what he gets? Most people get a resentment. Okay, most normal people would get a resentment, right? But alcoholics don't get a resentment. They get a resentment. Yeah. Excuse me. I hate it when that happens. They get a resentment. You know, they want to lay in their bushes with a flamethrower and all this kind of stuff. Just so you know, I didn't mean that. But anyway, that's what would happen. And I began to sabotage this guy and just backstab him and do him all kinds of things. And I could not understand why they were treating me this way after all these years, because I've been with them almost 11 years, all these years and all the hard work I had done and so forth. And I was really digging my own grave and never realized it. And then what happened is one day, by the way, did you ever drink down? I promise, this is about the time I started going to AA, because I knew I had to do something. He was talking to me about my drinking problem. And I promised I had to do something. I began to go to AA. Oh, I'm sorry. Thought it was my pacemaker going up. I began to go to AA, but I wasn't going to stop drinking. I wasn't going to... I think I drove my pen through my heart. I'm not sure. I was going to keep everybody happy, right? I was going to get the boss off my back and you know, look like I'm doing real good and I'm controlling it. And so I would control my drinking. I didn't tell him I was going to quit. He said, don't drink so much. So I wouldn't drink so much. But what I would do is I would stop off with my brother executives at a bar that they would go to after work, and I would have one or maybe two drinks. And then I would leave. So Jerry's doing okay. He just had two drinks, and he left. And then I'd go down the road to where some of the employees played pool at Spanky's, and I'd have one or two drinks. You know, and if there were some other employees there, then I'd leave. And I'd say, Jerry's doing okay. He only had two beers. And then I'd go down the road a little bit further. And I would finally end up at the north side of Charlotte at biker bars, dressed in a three-piece vested suit and wondering why my teeth hurt. it was terrible. There was a couple times that I always thought I was, you know, I always wanted to be a stand-up comedian, but I could never stand up long enough. So I would always get into trouble with people by making wisecracks to them, and what I was doing is I was insulting them. And the bikers did not have a sense of humor about that. And what happened was a couple of Japanese came to visit from out of town, and I was supposed to take them out to lunch, okay? Now, they didn't let me travel, but I was supposed, since I had lived in Japan for a while, and I understood, took them out to lunch. So we went to a watering hole, and we drank our lunch. And somehow, we never made it back to the office. Lunch just kind of drifted on into evening entertainment. You know how that works? And then drifted on into dinner. And then dinner drifted on into evening entertainment. Before the night was over, I had three fat, middle-aged Japanese businessmen at a biker bar in North Charlotte. You know, I don't know what I thought they... Oh, they don't call out there, you know, or something like that. And before the night was over, we were being chased out of the biker bar by guys on big motorcycles, you know, and I was running down the road, and I ran off I-85 into some woods and sideswiped a tree and just ironed the whole right-hand side of the car like it looked like it had been crinkled tinfoil and then ironed flat. And I took off the fender, took out the headlight, you know, the door handle, the mirror, and a couple of knuckles and fingernails and, you know, things like this. And the next day, the boss said, where were you? I mean, you never came back from lunch. And where are the Japanese? And I had to tell him, well, one's over at this hospital. He's in stable condition. One's been treated and released. He's resting back at the hotel. Yeah. And, you know, my boss just said, we love you, Jerry. You've been around for a long time. You've done a good job. But, man, we can't keep you on anymore. We just can't hold on to you. You know. And so he gave me an opportunity to resign. And what happened then is that there was a 2-year period after I was introduced to AA where it started progressing downwards. And there was no more insulating layers between the consequences of my behavior and me. Okay? And before that time, there had been some insulating layers. You know, my wife had kind of gotten in between it. Some police officers that were friends had kind of gotten in between it. Some attorneys that lived in the same neighborhood had gotten in between it. And my boss had gotten in between it, my immediate supervisor. But now there was no more layers of insulation. And I began to go through jobs like people go through underwear. And I began to wonder if maybe I might really have a problem. It's just to get to that zero stage now. And what you start to do, or what I started to do, was somehow prove that I didn't really have a problem. Okay? One of the jobs I took in those minutes, in that time period, was advertising sales. I always gravitated towards traveling jobs. And I would do fine when I was in town. But, you know, when you're out of town, nobody will know. Yeah. It's like one weekend I was supposed to drive home, and I knew I couldn't make it home. I mean, I was just too drunk to drive, and I called my wife, and I said, "Honey, I can't drive. I'm blind in one eye. I have an infection." You know, and she said, "Yeah, blind drunk. Al-Anons can smell your breath long distance over a phone. Did you know that?" I have never seen anything like that. They can do that. Blind, hung up on me. But anyway, there was a time where I had been sober for maybe 30 days or so. Okay, and you people would tell me things. You'd say, "Go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I said, "Well, you don't understand how busy I am." Okay? So I'd try it for a while, and then I'd slip. And I'd come back and I'd listen again. All right? And so I'd been sober for maybe 30 or 60 days, something like that. And I was supposed to meet a guy I was supposed to meet a guy in a bar. And half was the bar and half was the restaurant. I'm sitting in the restaurant drinking a soda, waiting for this man who didn't show up for his appointment and getting irritated. You know how alcoholics handle irritation? Handle any strong emotion, right? I never knew how to feel any emotion. I always had to deal with it by feeling nothing. And that's what I began to do. Not right away. I looked at the people over on the other side and I said, "You know, Jerry, you might not be a real alcoholic after all." You know, they say the real alcoholic can't just drink one drink. In fact, if you could step over to the bar side of this place and just drink one drink and then leave this place, you could prove that you're not a real alcoholic. And so I decided to try that. And I did better than that. I only ordered, drank half of a drink. I ordered a double and scotch. And I only drank half of a drink. Okay? Because no self-respecting alcoholic would leave anything in a bottle or a can or anything like that. And put the other half down on the counter, down in the bar, and got up and walked out. You know what that meant? Hot dog. I'm not an alcoholic after all. And I was so happy that I wasn't an alcoholic after all that on the way back to the motel room, I stopped off in an ABC liquor store to get something to celebrate the fact that I wasn't an alcoholic with. Okay? I mean, that's how that process happens. One of my later, in fact, the beginning of my last relapse, I had been sober. I had been dry. I was never sober. I never got a sponsor. I never got into steps. All I did was just show up and hope maybe I could just kind of get this thing. I always thought that there was some secret, you know. One day they're going to take me in the back room and they're going to give me the secret, you know. When I finally got a sponsor, he says, "Yeah, there's a secret. They put it right up there on the wall. You know, it's 12 steps." And I never understood that. And they read it in the beginning of every meeting. It's called How It Works. So they were like, "How's this thing work?" You know. And they read it in the beginning of every meeting. How it works, and it's the 12 steps, okay? But 87 days dry. And you know, one of the things about alcoholism is we tend to think, and this is the same for other addictions too, we tend to think that that substance out there outside of us is the problem, okay? And we went to visit my brother-in-law in Folly Beach, 87 days dry, the longest in 2 years, almost 2 years. And my brother-in-law liked to drink, and he liked to smoke pot. And he says, "Jerry, I know you can't drink anything, you're on the wagon and so forth, but how about going for a ride with me?" I knew what he was thinking. And I agreed to go for a ride with him. And he handed me the keys. He said, "You drive." Now I really knew what he was thinking, okay? I got in the car, and we started up, and he rolled up the tinted windows and turned on the air conditioning and opened the glove box and pulled out this bag, okay? began to roll a joint. And he says, well, I know it. You can't drink anything, but you can have a joint, can't you? And no, I better not. And I'm driving, inhaling deeply. Well, you know, he's lighting this thing up, and he's rolled up windows. All right? So he gets to finish it off. He says, well, I know you can't have a joint, but one hit won't hurt you, will it? I said, no, one hit won't hurt me. So he passed me the roach, you know. And then he's rolling up another one, and he lights it, and he passes it to me, and I start smoking it without even thinking about it. And we stop at a red light. And Bob starts laughing at me. Now, you got to remember, his tolerance for pot was up, and mine wasn't. Okay? And I don't know what he had, but he had some good stuff. Okay? And I said, what are you laughing at? He says, you're 50 feet from the red light. And I'm looking at him. Whoa! You know, you can tell when drunks are driving because they kind of weave. You know, when potheads drive, it's like driving with a broken speedometer. They kind of speed up and slow down. They speed up and they slow down, you know. And then they stop 30 feet from the red light, you know. And I feel like honking my horn, you know, unrolling the window and say, yeah, you know, quit smoking that wacky weed, you know. Well, holy no, you know. But, I mean, they just have no depth perception. They can't have any, you know, that type of thing. So I pulled up a little bit more. And then he's just roaring with laughter, you know. And you get giddy when you're drinking, you're smoking pot. And I said, what's wrong? You're still 30 feet. And I just said, oh, to hell with it. I'm already high. Let's just go get drunk. No thought of the consequences at all. Drove back from Folly Beach, South Carolina, drunk, with my wife and kids in the car to Charlotte, North Carolina, with my wife giving me what for all the way back. And the end of that evening, this is the beginning of the end. We had an argument, and I'll tell you, the nature of alcoholism is you say things you don't mean to say. You do things you don't mean to do. You hurt the people that you love, and you get consequences that you don't want to get. Okay? And I was beginning to hurt the people that I love. And my wife told me in no uncertain terms, she had never been down on them before, and instinctively she did the right thing. She said, if you want to destroy yourself, if you want to commit suicide on the installment plan, that's your business, but you're not taking me and the kids with you. You'll have to leave. And she was on the phone calling the police to make sure that I left. And I decided maybe I had better leave. So I left the house. And I started thinking, well, she probably called the city police. So I was driving south, I left the city. Then I started thinking about county sheriff. So I kept driving south and I, you know, left the county. Then I began to think about state troopers and FBI, you know. Anyway, what happened was I ended up here in Jacksonville, Florida, with credit cards from the company that I was working for that I just left, okay? Living on credit cards that were probably no good anymore, up and down sleazebag motel rooms on Phillips Highway, and ending up at the Expressway Inn on Beach Boulevard. Now, I want to tell you something. There is a reason that I chose the Expressway Inn. Number one, the little Indian guy didn't check the credit card, okay? Number two, it was across the street from the Malabar Lounge. And I said to myself, self, if you just don't drive, you can't possibly get in trouble. Okay? But this place, the Expressway Inn, was not one of your higher class motels, if you know what I mean. Okay? I mean, people did things like break locks and they didn't work anymore, so I put a chair up against the and that didn't, and I was worried about that. So around March, I took the snow chains off the car, you know? And I had them laying beside the bed, you know, on either side. I thought, well, this is good. You know, if they come through the door, I can go, whoosh, whoosh, you know, I can get them this way. Because the paranoia was setting in, too. You know, I knew they were after me. I knew I'd done some things wrong. And I didn't know who they were, but I knew they were after me. You know, that feeling where you're always kind of watching. Cocaine addicts call it the bent Venetian blind syndrome. I know they're up there, you know, that type of thing, okay? Well, the paranoia sets in, okay? And I worried about I didn't want to buy a gun because I knew I'd have to register with the police. So somebody told me that you can get a ship's flare gun. You don't have to register it, and that's good, you know, and I can get them, you know, coming through the door from a distance. So I bought this ship's flare gun, and I had it sitting on a nightstand. And one Saturday night, I went across the Malabar Lounge, and I knew to stock up on Saturday because they didn't serve booze on Sunday in Jacksonville. They did at the beach. I didn't know that. But they didn't serve it in Jacksonville. And I found out the hard way, you don't run out Saturday, you know, you stock up. So I went to the Malabar Lounge, and I began to drink and bought some booze, and I was stocking up. And I finally they said something like last call and asked me to leave. And as I was walking across the street, I was pretty well into my cuffs, and I couldn't gauge how fast these cars were coming and how far away they were, you know. You ever see somebody getting ready to get into a cold pool of water and they kind of stick their foot in, see how, if it's cold first? I was doing that on Beach Boulevard. I kind of, you know, see if anybody would, you know. Anyway, people would slam on their brakes and honk their horns, and they would wave at me without quite all their fingers and speak to me in four languages. And I was really worried about dropping those bottles, and I finally made it across Beach Boulevard, and I started to drink. And the more I drank, the madder I got, because I believed that those people were trying to get me personally. You know, there he is, that's Jerry West, let's see if we can hit him. You know, that type of thing. So I decided I'm going to get them before they get me. All right. So I got the flare gun, see, and I went between the bread trucks of this Merida bread place, and I would wait 3 o'clock in the morning for some car coming down Beach Boulevard, you know. Got your son, baby. You know. Guys slam on their brakes, you know, watch, you know. I can just see some pothead out there. Oh, wow, man, UFOs. And then I run back between the bread trucks, you know, and go back and hide in the motel room and peek out the curtain, and the guy get out of the car and look around, what the hell was that, you know, and laugh and drink some more, and then he'd go away, and I'd go out and do it again, you know. And I did it like three, four, five times. The blue lights would come, and they'd look around and didn't see anything, and then they'd leave. And finally, I, you know, like I say, alcoholics hate to waste anything. I had one flare left. And I couldn't stand up. So I knew I couldn't run between the bread trucks. And I hate to waste anything, you know, flares, drinks, anything. So I shot it in the motel room, you know. And it kind of ricocheted off a couple of walls around a corner, and it ended up sort of on his bed, and the bedspread caught on fire, and I pulled the thing off, and I threw it in the corner. But the corner I threw it in was the front door, and it had these long curtains coming down on either side of the front door. And the curtains caught on fire, you know. And I'm a pretty smart guy. I've been college educated. You know, I know how to put out a fire. I tried to pour vodka on it, and it just, you know, ceiling tiles caught on fire, start falling down. You know, I'm crawling around the room, I need to get out of this place. And the police were waiting right outside. I don't know why, you know. They'd only been called three times. And they saw the smoke and all that stuff, so they broke in and they put out the fire with the things. They found me huddled up in a fetal position next to the gas heater in this place, okay? And they took me to this room with no doorknobs on the inside, okay? Have you ever heard of resisting arrest? Okay, I bet you've never heard of resisting rescue. I wanted to be rescued, but not by those guys in those blue uniforms with cans of mace and nightsticks and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, they left me there. I didn't sober up in detox. You know, I got to sober up in a different kind of place. And I was there long enough where I had some time sober to think about it. And when I finally got out, you know, that was my last experiment at controlled drinking, that I told myself, you can't possibly get in trouble if you just don't drive. If you just stay in your motel room and don't do anything stupid, you can't get in trouble, okay? And it failed, okay? And I knew, and I got out, and I knew I was going to do it again. I didn't want to do it again. I may not have gone with a flare gun, but it would have been something, okay? I knew it was going to happen again. I knew I didn't want it to happen again, and I knew it didn't make any difference. If you left me to my own devices, whether I wanted to or not, whether I had good intentions or not, whether I had strong willpower in other areas of my life or not, it didn't make any difference. I was going to do it again. And I was hopeless. I was a hopeless alcoholic. I didn't think that there was anything left for me except maybe one thing. And that was, I had been to rooms like this where people who had apparently been like me at one point in their lives weren't like the way I was anymore. And maybe, just maybe, if they could get sober and happy at the same time. They were sober and happy. I never understood that. I always thought they were mutually exclusive. You can be sober or you can be happy. Okay, and that's because I always had happiness and excitement mixed up. I thought they were the same thing. But I didn't understand how people could be sober and happy at the same time. And I watched you all, and it wasn't fake, because nobody can keep up an act that long. And I didn't know how you did it. But I knew if I had any chance at all, that was going to be it. And so when they finally let me out, I had one place to call. And I'd never been to AA in Jacksonville. I'd been here 6 months drinking. And I stopped off and I called AA from a phone booth. And they told me about this little clubhouse on San Marco Boulevard near downtown where I was, called the San Marco Club. And I got in that old Dempsey dumpster mobile of mine and I started driving up and down San Marco Boulevard. And I'll tell you what, you know, you got to want to stay sober to find a San Marco Club when you're new in Jacksonville. You know, I'm driving down a road and, you know, and I see the Applejack's Lounge and Phoenix Lounge and Music Bar, you know. I'm looking at, where is this place, you know, and I'm looking at all these bars. And I knew I was going to end up at one of those places if I couldn't find this place. And I stopped off again. I said, you got to help me. I can't find him. They said, well, did you see Applejack's Lounge? Yeah, it's right across the street. You know, no wonder I didn't see it. I was looking at the bar, you know. You ever notice that? You ever notice that? Yeah. Try to remember how many hardware stores there are on the way home when you leave here tonight, between here and your house. You won't be able to remember. Try to think of how many bars there are. You'll know exactly how many bars there are, exactly where they are. Notice the things that you notice. I always treat alcohol differently. And I went in there, and I was going to be cool, and I was going to be, you know, I've been around AA for 2 years, you know. But I kind of, what I did is I sat, they had this kind of a porch area with pillars in it. And there was this one pillar that was situated just right, okay, right between the speaker's podium and a certain chair. Are you the newcomer? Right between a certain podium and the chair were the whoever was speaking or whoever was chairing the meeting couldn't see me, and I took that chair and I just sat back there. I thought, well, they can't see me, so nobody will say anything. And everybody knew that was the newcomer seat. That's where they all sat down, you know, and they walked in. Oh, you must be new. How are you? How they know? So at the end of the meeting, and I had never heard this in Charlotte, but down here they say something. They said, if there's anybody that's new or that has questions, I'd like to get some help, come forward to meet with me, your chairperson, afterwards. That's what they read at the end of each meeting. And there was this nurse named Vicky who was chairing the meeting. And I was going to be kind of suave, sophisticated, and cool, and I've been around AA, so were you, you know. And I walked up, and my name is Jerry, and I just fell into a massive blubber. What's wrong with me? And she knew better, you know, this guy's sick, he didn't need to be with a female type sponsor, you know, that type of thing. So she says, come on over here, I'll introduce you to somebody. And she introduced me to the man that was lovingly referred to at that time as the Big Book Nazi. I mean, this guy, he was good, and he was exactly what I needed. I needed somebody to direct me, to not put up with my bull, to not listen to what my mind was telling me and what my mind was telling other people. Because I started babbling about the reasons I drank. You ever do that? I tell you what happened. The wife, the house, because we lost the house, and the job, and this flicker, you know, all that kind of stuff. And he just stopped me. I mean, he didn't want to hear my whole history and all. He just stopped me, and he says, well, you've been around this program for a while? I said, yeah, I've been in and out for 2 years. He says, let me ask you something. He says, I want to ask you a couple questions. Because I asked him if he would help me. He says, let me ask you a couple questions first. And the first thing he says is, have you ever done steps 4 and 5? I said, no. And then he says, are you willing to? And believe it or not, you know what the first thought that crossed my mind was? What, and give all this up? You know, I mean, I had to stop and think, was I willing to? After all that, I had to stop and think, was I willing to do steps 4 and 5? And I knew I didn't have any choice. And I said, Ed, I'll walk on hot coals barefoot if you want me to. I just can't go on the way I'm going on. And I didn't know what was in front of me. If I ever get to heaven, I'm probably going to get into heaven the way I got into AA. You know, I'm probably going to stumble into it, backing away from hell, okay? Because that's the way I got into AA. I didn't go looking for sobriety. I had no idea what sobriety was. I was backing away from the way things were. And he says, okay. And the man talked to me until about 11 o'clock that night. And then he says, you got someplace to stay? Well, I think I need to call the expressway in. Because I had called the guy from jail and made some arrangements to make payments and all this kind of stuff. And so the charges. But anyway, He says, fine, can you stay sober till 8 o'clock tomorrow night? And I'm looking at my watch and thinking, how far away is that? Because I, honest to God, didn't know. I don't know. And he said, well, fine, Jerry, can you stay sober until noon? And then he added something. He said, any idiot ought to be able to stay sober till noon. You know, well, I didn't want him to think I was an idiot, okay? And there were times that I did have breakfast of champions, you know, beer and Rice Krispies. Instead of going snap, crackle, and pop, they just kind of lay there and hiccup and burp all morning, you know. But anyway, I didn't want him to think I couldn't stay sober until noon. So I said, well, of course I can. So he says, fine, I'll call you, or I'll come by and get you, and we'll go have lunch. And he worked at a hospital nearby that treated alcoholism. And sure enough, at lunch, he came by and got me, and we went to the San Marco Club. We ate lunch there. And lunch went on to like 2 or 3 o'clock. And he said, can you make it till 5? I said, yeah, I can make it a couple more hours. Fine, I got to go back to the office. I'll come back at 5. And then we had dinner at the San Marco Club. And then we waited around for the meeting at the San Marco Club, 8 o'clock. And then we talked till 11 o'clock at night. And you know what he said next? Do you think you can make it till 8 o'clock tomorrow night? See, my barrier was 90 days. I couldn't envision 90 days. But what he did, he says, you don't have to do this alone. That's what he was telling me, in effect. You don't have to do this alone. And all you got to do is a little bit. And I knew if I stuck with him and I stuck with those people, maybe I could do it. But I could not do it alone. I knew I would be safe. I knew they didn't serve booze in the San Marco Club. Okay? I knew I would be safe as long as I stuck around there. And next week we'll start talking about some of the implications of step one and what that means. And see, when he was asking me if I had done step 4 and 5, he already knew. When I said no, he already knew I had not done step one. Okay? Because if you're really powerless, if you're really hopeless, then you'll do whatever it takes. And if you're not willing to do that, then maybe I got a better way. Maybe I don't need to do this stuff. You know, that's for the real sick guys, you know. Maybe I don't need to go quite to those lengths. That makes sense? Ran a little bit over, and I really appreciate your patience tonight. And one last thing, if I can, I just want to read this to you. Two ways to get into this program. Okay? End of step one in the 12 and 12. Many less desperate alcoholics tried AA but did not succeed because they could not make the admission of hopelessness. And he doesn't use powerlessness. He says hopelessness. And he says later on, people who hadn't gotten to the low bottom that the first 100 did were able to get sober. How is that possible? He said by raising the level of the bottom so that they could see what was out there for them. Okay, by raising their bottom, by getting them to see where they were headed and getting them to believe where they were headed so they could stop now. And when they could make that admission of hopelessness, just as much the people that had the low bottom, then they could get sober. Two ways. Experience the experience or believe the experience. Okay? Love you all, and ain't a damn thing you can do about it.